That's right. Happy Saturday, my dudes. It's Campbell Knezvik here on ESPN 102.5. The game, as always, I'm Elijah Campbell. I told you last night on the 6 at the end that we're going to be back at it this morning. Here in the Hillside Medical Studios, Jared Cassidy behind the glass, and all the way from Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, our co-host,
yes,
Michelle Knezvik. Michelle, you're on the phone today. We're having some computer issues, I understand.
Well, Elijah, it's always something, but listen, we figure out how to make it work. I'm signing in from the Steel City this morning. Shout out to my best friend who lives here. So a nice little trip, seeing a college friend, going to see a comedy show last night.
Nice.
Signing in from the Steel City. Surprisingly not here for a sporting event. That's a big deal.
See, usually I think Pittsburgh, I'm thinking, I'm like, oh, well, the Penguins aren't playing. The Steelers aren't playing. The Pirates maybe was an option. But, I mean, the only way you go to a Pirates game is someone gives you tickets. I can't imagine wanting to watch the Pittsburgh Pirates. But which comedy show did you see last night?
So it's called Girls Gotta Eat. It's a podcast we've been listening to since college. And we actually bought the tickets, like, in probably 6 months ago in the fall, and I kind of forgot about it. And then you buy these tickets, and then all the excitement kind of goes away from the event. And then when it comes up and we saw them yesterday, like, it was probably one of the best comedy shows I've ever been to.
Oh, wow.
So if you're listening and never been to a comedy show, so worth the money. We laughed the entire time. They even had some jokes about Pittsburgh sports and everything. So definitely worth the money. But, yeah, sign in from Steel City, and, yeah, we're going to have a great day. Talk a lot of Preds today, Elijah, maybe a little bit of Titans, but mostly Preds, mostly Hines, mostly Doyle. Got a lot to uncover on that front today.
And, of course, my favorite story of the week, the Jimbo Fisher-Nick Saban feud. We'll definitely get into that later, because I think that is a coaching feud of biblical proportion, and I'm so excited to break that down. But you did mention the Preds and John Hines and David Poyle, because they had their end of season press conference, maybe a smidge later than usual, but not by much. But where they did announce John Hines' extension, and they kind of were honest about the direction of the franchise and what the plan is moving forward. I know we've had people call in and harass poor Willie Donick, because if that man had hair on his head, he wouldn't have had hair on his head by the end of last week, because of how many people were calling in to ask about the plan, or said they're confused about the plan, and then Willie having to preach to them about what the plan is. But they discussed that plan and what's going to be like moving forward, and whether you agree with it or not, there is at least a concrete plan in place. And part of that plan is now going to be with John Hines being the coach for at least the next 2 years, if according just to his contract length. But Michelle, you heard the press conference. You guys have talked about it extensively on Robbie and Rex Road. But what were your first, I guess, takeaways with the message that David Poyle and John Hines got together and kind of relayed to the media and Preds fans on Thursday?
Well, I think the main message was obviously the John Hines situation, which was kind of the number one, I would say, aside from Philip Forsberg, you know, figuring out what the status of John Hines and David Poyle were moving forward, right? So you got to see, are they deciding, are they going to hire a new coach, are they not? But obviously, there was a rumor about 6 years. I did think that was definitely a rumor at the point, and I think once we saw that come across Twitter, we pretty much on Robbie and Rex Road shot that down pretty quickly. We were like, yeah, that seems very far-fetched. I highly doubt that.
Very.
He's getting signed, you know, for 6 years. That's too much, essentially. And we thought, maybe why aren't they going to take the one-year option? And then we find out that they're extending him 2 years. So a little bit more than that one-year option, giving him an extra year on that front. And then I think, you know, they addressed the Philip Forsberg thing, which is going to be a huge part of the plan, right?
I mean, it's first domino
like
to fall.
Poyle, yeah, exactly. I feel like David Poyle, you know, has made it clear that's pretty much, now that you know the coaches are here, that's the first thing on the list. And he said, we've got plan A, which is signing Philip Forsberg. No surprise. That's what all Predators fans want. if you want to be competitive in this league. We saw what performance he had this year. You need a strong forward like him. And then they said, hey, we've got plans B, C, D, E, and F, and they didn't really go into, you know, specific detail. But I think that David Poile took a lot of responsibility, which I liked. You know, he said, John Hines did a great job coaching. And I think from my perspective, you know, throughout this whole season and everything, it wasn't Hines. I think Hines did a good job, you know, with the cards he was dealt. He wasn't dealt this team where he's got all these superstars. And, yeah, we can see the aftermath of it now. And, you know, Roman Josi having just a historic season. And Matthew Shane, you know, scoring over 40 goals. Philip Forsberg. But if you were to tell us this a year ago, we could have never predicted this would have happened. And the expectations heading into the season, I mean, nobody even, and I know people are going to be like, oh my gosh, they kept saying that during the press conferences because everybody's like, didn't predict us to go to the playoffs, which I get.
Mm-hmm.
But I think John Hines did a great job. I think this was more on Poile of he hasn't given John Hines the pieces to make a deep run. You don't have, you know, a Sidney Crosby on the team. You don't have a superstar, which in the NHL, you need to have those superstars if you want to make a deep run. It's just, I feel like it's the one sport where, yeah, you can have second-round picks, you can have late first-round picks, and they can be good, solid players in the NHL, but if you don't have that piece, that one, you know, superstar, like, if you don't have a great quarterback in the NFL, don't get me wrong, we have seen, you know, some win the Super Bowl. I'm thinking Eagles yes. A little bit on that front, but I mean, it's pretty much the common denominator. So, I mean, I guess my takeaways from the press conference were I think David Poile took responsibility. I think they told us what they can about a plan moving forward. And then, you know, John Hines, he got his extension. And I was pretty much pleased with it. They talked for a very long time. I mean, what were your initial takeaways from it, Elijah?
I definitely did notice a little bit of diving in front of some bullets that David Poile did for John Hines, some responsibility claiming, which I can understand, especially because when you announce at the beginning of the press conference that you've extended the head coach, you kind of have to justify doing that within the same breath. And of course, he mentions the one main takeaway I had in that opening statement was he mentions John Hines' ability to be able to develop players. And like there's two parts of developing players that I usually focus on with this Preds team because of the way they're of the state of the team. And that's like the competitive rebuild, competitive retooling, whatever way you want to describe it. They have used a plethora of ways to describe the exact same thing. And that's being good while also retooling the back end of your roster and the top end. Developed well. Like all last year we complained about you're not getting enough out of Ryan Johansson, you're not getting enough out of Matt Duchene. You know, Philip Forsberg could probably do more. You need those guys to do really well if you want to be able to make like these big runs. And to John Hines' credit, even though it took a little bit of time, you did start to see that out of those guys. Like obviously you had 40 plus goal seasons from Matt Duchene and Philip Forsberg with the Matt Duchene thing coming completely out of left field, considering you were just willing to let the Seattle Kraken take him in the expansion draft this past summer for absolutely nothing. They were willing to part with Matt Duchene for nothing in return just to get his contract off their hands. And then this year, he's one of your best players in the playoffs. He arguably was your best player. So I think there was some development there. Even Matt Duchene has said, even in his exit interviews at the end of the season, that it took a little while. But once like, they figured each other out, once John Hines figured out how these guys tick, they were able to get on the same page and they were able to maximize a lot of their value, which is part of player development. Player development isn't just getting young players to turn into productive veterans. It's getting your formerly productive veterans to actually be centerpieces on your team. I think that was achieved. The other end is where he can get a little tricky. I think Phil Tomasino developed well, and Tanner Janot, I think, was really hot at the beginning of the season, but he fell back down to earth in his last 16 games in the month, or the last 15 games in the month of April. He had 1 point. One goal, no assist, 1 point was a -7 while he was on the ice. You didn't get anything out of Cunningham in those last 2 months. You didn't get anything out of Eli Tolvanen in those last 2 months. And the Eli Tolvanen one especially is the one that we've been told by the franchise is the guy who was a goal scorer. Like, this guy is here to score goals. He's not here to almost score goals. He is here to score goals. So while I understand he was snake-bitten essentially at the end of the year and had a hard time actually putting the puck in the net, like, he's here to do that. So what I'm looking for, once he said that, I'm like, okay, the mission next year is to get those guys along to where you don't have that much pressure on those veteran players to be able to do everything in the playoffs. Because what we saw was Matt Duchene play really well, to no avail, essentially. Philip Forsberg not score a goal until game four, in third period of game four. And if those guys aren't carrying you, and Roman Josi, if those three aren't carrying you when UC Saros isn't there, you don't stand a chance against Colorado. And that's exactly what we saw, especially if young guys not named Yakov Trenin aren't stepping up. So that's the mission next year. Like, John Hines got that extension because they're seeing what he can do with those younger players because they believe he can bring them along. However, if we see a lot of the same stuff this next year and those guys don't develop and you see some natural regression from Philip Forsberg and Matt Duchene, then assuming Forsberg comes back, then we might be having a different conversation. But I thought for the most part, Michelle, there was a lot of David Poile kind of taking the blame, that saying he hasn't put the roster around him that is required to win, which is true to a degree. However, I feel like there was some equal blame, but we'll get into more of that too. On the other side, there's a whole lot from that press conference to dissect. There's a whole lot more about the direction of the team that is a discussion that needs to be happening in this market and will. A big offseason coming up for the Nashville Predators, and we'll get into that on the other side as you're listening to Campbell Knezovic right here on ESPN 102.5 The Game, 106.3 in The Game Nashville app.
David, are you worried?
Not at the level we needed to. You know, I think when you look at the playoffs, as David said, I thought we faced a team that was, you know, they were, I think they're hungry. Their experience from last year, you know, I think when you look at them, they swept St. Louis in the first round and they lost to Vegas. You know, they were all in this year. So I think what we learned from that was we didn't get to our game good enough in the playoffs. And I think some of that is to Colorado, and some of that's on us, and some of that's on me. So I think that, you know, as I said, I think there's some really good components there. But we've all got to be better to get to a level where that series can be much more competitive than it was.
John Hines on what the postseason identity is supposed to be for this team. That was said on Thursday in their press conference after the season. And there's some truth to that. You know, like he mentioned before, because that was Caroline's follow-up. She's like, what do you want the identity to be for this Predators team? And he's like, you don't want to be physical, you want to be tough to play against. Like, that's great. And they were in the regular season. They led the entire league in penalty minutes and fighting majors. Like, they did all the stuff that teams that are tough hockey teams did all the stuff they do. But in the playoffs, it's harder to do that against a team that is just bigger, faster, stronger than you. And if you don't toe that line between aggressiveness and legality, you're going to find yourself in the penalty box against a team that has one of the best power plays in the sport, and that's going to absolutely murder you, and you saw that on several occasions. So, Michelle, you heard John Hines talk about a postseason identity. What, I guess, do you think the Preds need to be able to do this offseason to be able to mold that identity that he envisions, and one that's actually going to be able to take them past the first round, which is something we haven't been able to talk about in this market in almost 4 years?
Yeah, Elijah, I think, you know, listening to that clip of Hines and talking about, you know, they need that postseason identity because throughout the regular season, it was pretty promising. It looked like the team was on the come up. Hey,
I think we lost her. She froze up. The computer problems are back. No, there she is. No, proceed.
We got her.
Yeah, she got robo-Michelle'd. Robo-Michelle made an appearance in the second segment of the show.
Listen, 2 hours. It's been a morning.
That's
fine. We're going to figure it out. It's okay. Finally got the Zoom up. We're working on the live
stream.
Yeah,
so if you're watching the stream now, you have Michelle present. So she's off the phone, now on the computer. So we're making some progress here.
Step by step. What I was saying was the best thing that I've ever said ever, but it was just Robo. No, I'm kidding. John Hines in that clip, you know, talks about the postseason identity and how, you know, during the regular season, it was pretty promising. Like, they had some great wins. I think about that Colorado win at home where everybody was like, oh my gosh, they just beat Colorado. And don't get me wrong, I know there were players missing, you know, on both sides. But then once they got into the postseason and Stanley Cup playoffs, that first game, I think everybody was like, whoa, Colorado's really good and the Preds cannot keep up. I think after the first game, mm-hmm. people were talking about, oh wow, this series could be a sweep. People already counting the Predators out.
Felt like, and it after the first period. It was so brutal.
And I think one thing that I noticed was, and we talked about this during the regular season too, you think about the stars on the team, right? You've got UC Saros, who carried this team in so many games this year. So many saves that I don't know how the kid did it. Kid, he's older than me. I don't know how he did it.
I can call him that because he's technically younger than me by a month. So.
And they, you know, they put him in some tough positions and UC Saros rose to the occasion, but then obviously gets injured towards the end of the season. Tanner Janot, I don't think anybody expected a season like this from him or thought that he could even perform like this. And then it's a really long season. And towards the end of it, in the playoffs, kind of saw him fall off. Even the last, you know, 15 games of the regular season, he went for a stretch where he didn't have a point in any of those games, which was rare considering his performance he had put on the whole first, you know, 3/4 of the season. Mm-hmm. And then you obviously have Philip Forsberg, who was a huge contributor offensively for you. You had Matt Duchene, Ryan Johansson stepping up, obviously Roman Josi as well. And you had other role players stepping up in games here or there. Mikhail Granlund, Yakov Trenin, Ellie Tolvanen, very briefly.
Yeah. Emphasis on the very for Tolvanen.
But I think, you know, saying all of that and concluding to a point was these superstars on this team had to carry the team. Mm-hmm. And if they weren't having a night where they were scoring or they were having a good game, the team wasn't in it.
Yeah.
And you need more production around the team, or you need to get guys, you need to get two more forwards that have great goal production, because point blank, you needed more scorers out there.
The second line was pretty rough this year. You didn't get much production from whoever was on the second line. You know, your first line was great. Second line was non-existent at times. And then whatever you got from the herd line, you got from the herd line, and which is always usually pretty good. That's one of the better specialty lines of forwards in the NHL. And like, I definitely agree with the depth too. That's like one thing. That's one thing about this Preds situation, Michelle, that there is some positivity because they have a ton of cap space. And like David Poile mentioned, they plan on spending to the cap. And he did say there's not going to be as much if they give Philip Forsberg, they re-sign Philip Forsberg, which I think they're going to do. I don't think both sides are very far off. I would be stunned if he walks. So assuming you sign him, you can still go after someone like Nazem Kadri from Colorado, who would be perfect on your second line, who would be a guy who had a career year with the Avalanche. Like, I know he hasn't had a great playoff so far for Colorado, and that whole team was non-existent in game 2 against St. Louis, but there's some wiggle room there, and it's not a terrible free agent class, but like, I'm looking at someone at like Nazem Kadri from Colorado to be like, you can sign a guy like that, and that's going to make your second line better. But back to your point, like, they can't be too reliant on UC Saros. Like, I can't remember what stat it was, Michelle, and if you remember what it is, tell me. But it's he led the league, and basically the stat is like games that you stole, where the other team had more expected goals than your team, but the goalie played so well that they didn't score actual goals because the goalie stood on his head. It was like game steals or something like that. The Athletic did a really good story on it. And UC Saros led the league in that by a mile. They estimated he stole 11 games. If UC Saros doesn't steal 11 games, you're not even in the playoffs. And we saw the disparity of what happens to this team when he's not in there versus when he is in there. It's a whole different team whenever UC Saros is in net. I don't know if they would have beaten Colorado still, but like they have to figure out something in terms of not relying too much on your goalie, because all these teams that are winning cups or making deep playoff runs don't just have solid goaltending. The goaltending is good enough to win them games and steal them games, but they have other pieces that can win them games even when they do give up three or four goals.
No, I completely agree. And I think as far as, you know, Predators fans, I think what we saw from Connor Ingram in the Stanley Cup playoffs was promising.
Mm-hmm.
And I especially in game two, I think that moving forward, he would be a better second option to UC, at least for next year.
Oh,
and
yeah.
David Riddick, I don't see him being on the roster. Or I don't know what his contract looks right now. I don't know if he was on getting...
I want to say he was a one-year deal.
One year, so yeah.
I think it expires after this year, which means it's probably not coming back. I'll double-check that. But I thought I did see where his would expire this year. And I just... And if that's the case, I don't see him coming back just because I think you saw enough from Connor Ingram. I know Hines wasn't committal or gave like a kind of a non-committal answer when he was talking with Chase about that on the Preds wrap-up show. But I think if you put some truth serum in there, I think it is we feel comfortable with Connor Ingram more so than they did Riddick, especially the way they handled their playoff situations.
The other
Jared?
Nope, go ahead, Michelle.
I was just going to say, then it's promising for fans because UC Saros doesn't have to play so many games. I mean, they made it clear that they played him a lot more during this long season than they had planned to at the beginning of the year.
I was just going to say that it does give you a little bit of a more of a hindsight, I guess, coming up is that Askarov is going to be down in Milwaukee too.
Yeah,
that's
finally
another wrench in this system that you don't necessarily, you might be able to be okay without Big Save Dave. So then if you have Ingram in the back of Saros and then you have Askarov down in the wings waiting, I just think you're setting yourself up for the long run.
Yeah, and that's really true too. Like that's going to be a piece moving forward. That's a guy you draft in the first round. You drafted him in the first round because he's going to be a part of your future moving forward. So Connor Ingram could be a fine stopgap, and we'll see because Connor Ingram only played two games in the regular season before UC Saros got hurt and he was thrusted into action for one game later, the last game of the regular season. So he was put in a really tough position, but like that's another thing too that John Hines is going to have to figure out. I know I mentioned player development earlier, but you're going to have to figure out like the goalie situation because UC Saros led the league in goalies in terms of games played. He started 67 games. That is a massive workload. And to be able to give you a frame of reference, like Carey Price, one of the best goalies of our generation, has historically had an insanely high workload his entire career. Had one 72 game season where he started 70 games of those 72 that he appeared in, and then has played in at least 60 games or started at least 60 games in 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 other seasons. That is insane. And that's not even including a lockout shortened year and a COVID shortened year, 1920, in which they had a shortened regular season. He still played 58 games, which led the league in goalies. And you've seen that has kind of broken him down, you know? He was doing all that by the age of 31. UC obviously is just turned 27. Let's say he's a month separated than
he's a spring chicken.
A spring chicken, but he won't be for long if you keep running him into the ground too, because you look at the season that Carey Price won the Hart as a goalie, winning the Vezina and the Hart, had that 44 win season, started 66 games, his body broke down a little bit. He only played 12 the next season. Then he had another 62, another great 62 start season, and then hadn't been as productive ever since then. And that's what you want to avoid. You don't want that kind of workload to be bestowed onto UC Saros, and that's going to be a big element of this Preds team moving forward. But I teased it at the beginning of the show, guys, and I want everybody's thoughts on this. I'm welcoming calls, 615-737-1025 on our phone and text line. We even got a text in from Corey who said Rex Rhodes' tech issues are rubbing off on Michelle. It is a
blame Rex Rhodes.
It is a contagious phenomena here in this studio where the Zoom robotics will kick in anytime someone is on Zoom and doing the show remotely. But that's how it is. And Corey, thank you for texting in. If anybody has any other thoughts on the Preds, feel free to call or text in. And I have a feeling we'll get some calls and texts on this topic coming up, because Jimbo Fisher ethered Nick Saban this week. The closest thing to Noss's ether we will see in a college football press conference in our lifetime. If you've missed it, if you've lived under a rock, or if you haven't gotten on Twitter in the last 72 hours, we'll fill you in next. You're listening to Campbell and Knezovic right here. ESPN 102.5, 106.3 The Game, The Game Nashville app.
First of all, I'll say it's a shame that we have to do this. It's really despicable. It's despicable that somebody can say things about somebody and an organization. More importantly, 17-year-old kids. You're taking shots at 17-year-old kids and their families. And they broke state laws. They're all money. We bought every player on this group. We never bought anybody. No rules were broken. Nothing was done wrong. It was all in the way we do things, the ethics in which we do things. And these families, it's despicable that a reputable head coach could come out and say this when he doesn't get his way or things don't go his way. The narcissist in him doesn't allow those things to happen, and it's ridiculous. But when he's not on top, and the parity in college football he's been talking about, go talk to coaches who coach for him. You'll find out all the parity. Go dig into wherever he's been. You can find out anything. And it's a shame that you got to sit here and defend 17-year-old kids and families and Texas A&M, because we do things right. We're always going to do things right. But we're always going to be here.
Ooh. The word narcissist was used. He blamed the lack of parity in college football on Nick Saban's past. He eventually goes on that press conference to refer to him as God sarcastically on multiple occasions. That was Jimbo Fisher's verbal evisceration of Nick Saban on Thursday in response to Nick Saban insinuating that they're buying all of their players, which A, they might be. And by they, I mean the NIL collective, not Texas A&M, because there's a difference. And B came off a lot like sour grapes, like someone who finally doesn't get their way in recruiting, doesn't get the number one recruiting class for 1 year, and then has to take pot shots at the team that does actually dethrone him in the world of college football recruiting. That's what's going on between Jimbo Fisher and Nick Saban. Michelle, I haven't gotten your thoughts from this yet, too, because our schedules for the during this this week have been mixed up a little bit. So this is our first time really speaking since that happened. I'm dying to hear what you're thinking about this and what exactly this is for college football. Because personally, this has made me more excited for October 8th, 2022 than I ever would have been for that specific date if this didn't happen.
Elijah, all I have to say is sips tea.
Sips tea dramatically.
Literally, everybody after this happened, well, first off, Nick Saban does this in Birmingham, mm-hmm. right? In front of donors.
Yeah.
Like, weren't you just asking for money before this was said?
He basically put her on an offering plate at that point.
First off, I think this is the most incredible thing ever, and I am so here for it. And like you said, I am so much more excited to watch Texas A&M and Alabama play this season, but I'm almost more excited to analyze to see, are Jimbo and Saban going to look at each other? Like, what's going to happen? You know, the press conferences, or is Alabama just going to absolutely roll over Texas A&M and beat them by like 35 points?
that's gonna be one of those games that if Alabama is up like 3 or 4 touchdowns in the last quarter, you bet that Nick Saban is going for it on fourth down. They're throwing the ball late in the game. They are going to run it up, both sides. Even if, like, Texas A&M somehow is able to get that big lead. The game's going to be in Tuscaloosa this year, so I highly doubt Texas A&M is going to be garnering this large lead going into the last 3 or 4 minutes of the game. But they'll be doing the same thing. They might be faking punts up 28, whoever it is that is on the winning side of that blowout.
All gas, no brakes on that game. But, yes. No, I mean, Elijah,
it's personal.
When we played the Nick Saban hit single. And it wasn't a press conference, right? Like it just was, he was talking to essentially people who would potentially be donors for the school, right? In Birmingham, Nate Oates is sitting next to him. Like, is this happening? Is this up? Is this?
You knew Nate Oates was sitting there and just, he knows damn well this is going to be a soundbite used in every media forum in the United States. He knew
Nate
he was
Oates,
part
like,
of the body.
It's happening. It's happening. Oh gosh. Okay. Yep. He's not stopping.
Nope.
Okay. Here we go. And unfortunately, we always, Robbie, Joe, and I always joke about this, that everything fun happens after our show ends. And when we were on the show this week, it was Thursday, because then we talked about it on Friday. And Texas A&M had tweeted out Jimbo Fisher presser at 10 a.m. today. And it was funny because obviously that was pretty much the same time that John Hines and David Poyle had their press conference, mm-hmm. and everybody is like live streaming this Texas A&M one. I pulled it up right on my phone as soon as I got off work. And I didn't really know what to expect from Jimbo Fisher. I didn't know how he was going to address it. But I mean, we heard not too long ago the comments about Sliced Bread Man on Twitter saying that
robot,
you know, we pay for our players and all this stuff, and that the Aggies, we got the best university, blah, 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 all this stuff. Right. So that was just like the little appetizer to what we got from Jimbo Fisher right here.
Mm-hmm.
And I put out a poll on our 102.5 The Game Twitter on Friday, which I'm a little surprised at the response to it. I wrote Team Jimbo, Team Saban. And 55% was Team Saban and 44% was Team Jimbo, which I am 1000% Team Jimbo in this. First off, half the stuff Nick Saban was saying was just completely wrong. Wrong and sour grapes. He's just seeming like we get it. In football, you have been far above everybody else for a very long time now, consistent over many years, you know, most national championships. And all of that. And I think now, right, you see Kirby Smart, he had more first round draft picks than mm-hmm. Saban. Jimbo Fisher beat him last year, right? These are all guys that essentially you could say they coached him. He was their mentor, right? Or whatever in coaching, and now have gone on to have very successful coaching careers at big SEC schools as well. And when Texas A&M got a better recruiting class than him, I mean, Saban just seems like
unhinged, almost.
A sore loser in this mm-hmm. situation. And for Jimbo just to unravel, I feel like he just opened the closet and like skeletons fell out. But one thing I wish that somebody said at the press conference when he was saying, you go ask anyone who coached underneath him, you know what's going on, yada, yada, all this stuff, like alluding to a lot of things. Uh-huh. I wish somebody would have been like, well, you were on his staff at one point. Tell us.
Yeah, like what? You know, like what? You know, and I love, like, here's my thing. I don't necessarily am on team either of these guys. I think they're both narcissists. I think they are both the reason that we have a lot of this, this culture in college sports. Like, they created this. Like, you are big name coaches who did whatever it took to win. I know he said, like, later on he goes, you know, I'm not a liar, I'm not a cheat. And blah, 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 blah. We do things the right way at A&M. Like, whatever, sure. Like, whatever now everything's the right way because, like, we've legalized actually being able to monetarily reward players for their talents, which is, I mean, there's nothing wrong with that. There's nothing wrong with that to begin with other than it was against the NCAA's stupid rules. But Jimbo going at and saying, you know, I learned under Bobby Bowden, the best of the best. Like, I don't want to tarnish, I don't want to tarnish Bobby Bowden's name. However, Steve Spurrier used to refer to FSU as Free Shoes University for a reason, all right? Like, those guys weren't doing everything clean there. Alabama's never done anything clean there, and we know that there might be some shady stuff going on at Texas A&M in order to get those NIL deals done. There's no honor amongst these guys, so all of them, yeah, like, complaining about the other, to me, is like me playing the world's smallest violin. I'm just a little madder at Nick Saban because it's like, dude, you've had every recruiting advantage for the last decade.
Ever.
And don't point at somebody else for having, like, recruiting improprieties when your first number one recruiting class came after a 7-6 season at Alabama. What connections are we supposed to make there? I don't completely buy that Alabama is like that not buying players, because Nick Saban's also the same guy, Michelle, that bragged about Bryce Young getting a 7-figure NIL deal before they took a snap last season.
Yeah. And when you say things like that, okay, what is your motive into saying things like that? To get these players, they're 18-year-old kids. Of course, that amount of money to them is
life-changing.
First, life-changing to anybody. Mm-hmm. They can't even fathom that amount of money. You tell them they're going to make 50 grand and their eyes light up. And you say a million? Like, I mean, come on. I agree. I think, first off, I think what Nick Saban said, it's like, what are you doing? You can just tell, though, he's gotten to the age where he does not, as of recent, I mean, he's always kind of been a little bit like this, but he is just really does not care now what he's saying. And then, honestly, good for Jimbo that he's like, you know what? I'm not just going to let you do this. Nick Saban has been running college football. Everybody has been, he has been the superior to everyone for years. And I think the way that I look at it is Jimbo's like, no. I'm not underneath you anymore. And I'm going to come out with my own press conference. And we got a better recruiting class than you. And
we beat you last year.
And I'm about to roast you on not even what we're talking about now, but a lot of other things that now people are going to be like, raise their eyebrows to, like, oh, well, can you tell us a little bit more, Jimbo? Like, I honestly did not know you. I feel like you could have asked Jimbo anything in that press conference and you did not know what he was going to spit out of his mouth. Like, you could have got some extra tea from that. But Elijah, I 1000% agree with everything you were saying there. This has been happening in college athletics for years. And now the fact that it is, quote unquote, legal, right? NIL, players can make money and monetize that money off their name, image, and likeness. And technically, it's not pay for play, but
it's pay, yeah.
You find a loophole.
It's pay for play.
You're not actually getting, yeah.
Yeah.
So, I mean, okay, so now they can talk about it. And now it's like you were doing everything you were doing before, but now you can openly talk about the competition between money and paying players and, you know, getting them to come to your school. And it just seems like a petty fight between the both of them. Nick Saban seems like a sore loser. And then Jimbo Fisher stands up like, oh, well, we are honorable people here. And it's like, come on.
It's like, we know you're enticing these kids with your blood oil money here. We know, man. You're not hiding this from anybody. But props to Texas A&M, because you know what? They're doing one thing that I think not only – I don't think the main reason Nick Saban is saying this, because I know Nick Saban knows he's going to come off as whiny. He knows he's going to come off as a sore loser. But I think you actually hit on it earlier, Michelle, that the main reason he might have said that was for something other than just airing grievances. And we'll tell you what that is on the other side. You're listening to Campbell and Knezovic right here on ESPN 102.5, 106.3 The Game and the Game Nashville app. Oh, yeah. I love in that last promo, they're like, they're going to be huge, which is true. And it's exactly how I feel after each trip to Taco Bell. It's ironic. Campbell Knezovic here, ESPN 102.5, 106.3 The Game, The Game Nashville app. And, man, there was a verbal evisceration of Nick Saban that came from the mouth of Jimbo Fisher that was sparked by comments made by Nick Saban earlier in the week where he tells, I don't know what it was, Michelle. Was it like some kind, it was some kind of, like, it wasn't a press conference. It was like some kind of Rotary Club meeting or whatever the hell it is they're doing in Birmingham in front of an audience and some round table discussion. But
I think it was some sort of round table discussion. And essentially the people in the crowd, I think, were
donors, maybe?
Had some moolah to spend, probably.
And if it is donors, then this makes my theory have a little more merit. So Nick Saban knows that when he complains about another team getting all the best recruits, quote unquote, buying the best recruits, even though, like, I think we all know that the NIL collectives at Texas A&M have some pockets as deep as the wells in which they're bringing the oil from. They're pretty deep. They make a lot of money in Texas. Texas A&M for decades has been a school that has had tons of resources. So it's easy to make that assumption. And it's also well documented that a lot of these guys, especially tight ends, have NIL deals in place the minute they get to Texas A&M. So Nick Saban says they bought all of their recruits. We only have NIL deals for like three or like a small number. And he's basically complaining about it. It almost sounds like he's whining and crying about an unfair advantage, which I think he knows he would come off as. But I think he's doing it strategically, Michelle, because in a very New England Patriots-esque way where it's everybody do your job, Nick Saban has been doing his job because before any of this mess was legal, he was recruiting players and having the number one recruiting class most of the entire time he was at Alabama. He's won all these national championships. He wins the SEC championship almost every year. The college football playoff is essentially the Alabama Invitational because Nick Saban and those guys have been doing their job for the last decade. I think what he might have been saying, Michelle, in between the lines to that audience that was there, if they were donors, I've been doing my job. Now that this is legal, it's time for you guys to do your jobs and to do them better.
Elijah, I completely agree with that. So I looked it up just to double check. So it was an event with local business leaders in Birmingham. So
local business leaders, yes. Car dealers, barbecue business owners. Yeah, but it's a booster meeting. Jared nailed it. It's a booster meeting, essentially.
Mm-hmm. It's the collective.
It's the collective.
What everybody calls, you know, these donors and how these players are getting these big NIL deals. And Elijah, I think you hit the nail on the head. Nick Saban has been doing this job long enough to know and be aware as to what he is saying during a press conference. Mm-hmm. He isn't just, you know, rolling off stuff in the heat of the moment. He knows exactly what he is doing. And when somebody brought up, I don't know if I saw it on Twitter or I heard one of our shows talking about it, but they said what you said, you know, wasn't Nick Saban 10 minutes before saying all this Jimbo Fisher in Texas A&M about how they pay every single player, talking to business leaders about his football program. Nate Oates is sitting right next to him, basketball, Alabama athletics. They hold a lot of weight in that town because they don't have professional sports teams and Alabama football is their professional pre-NFL team, right? Exactly. They're just wearing those Alabama jerseys. And I think he knew exactly what he was doing in this situation. And another reason I say that is because he has not made a comment back to Jimbo Fisher after that. I think he's like, yep, I did exactly what I want to do. And you know, when Alabama fans heard that press conference from Jimbo Fisher, oh, they were heated and they're taking Nick Saban's side. And if you have money to spend and you're in Alabama and you're a huge Alabama football fan, what do you think you're going to do with it, especially after this?
And for those who haven't heard it, we'll go ahead and play this for you. That way we'll let you decide what the subliminal messaging is in this message. And Jared, take it away. More and more people are doing it. We can't sustain it. We need help. Pass the plate around and let's get us some money so we can contend. That's what I heard. That was my messaging there.
Essentially, you better help us out or Alabama football is not going to be good in the future.
Yes. And Alabama fans,
that's like, oh gosh, no.
That's almost like, what's the, like, picture the largest department store you can think of, or like the largest, it's like Amazon almost, not department store, Amazon being like, we're going out of business, we need you, we need donations. Like, Alabama's got money. All of them got money. They can compete in any recruiting resource on the planet. There is not a recruit the University of Alabama cannot get for football. If they want him, they're getting them. And even if it's a guy they're not going to use, they're getting him so they can sit on the bench for 3 years for the hopes of maybe playing one day for the greatest coach in the history of college football and the most dominant dynasty college football has ever seen. I don't buy for a minute their recruiting tactics are not sustainable in 2022.
Get used to it.
Get used to it.
Or 2023 or 2024 or moving forward.
Moving forward. These guys have all of the money, the sliced bread, if you will.
Sliced bread.
On the planet to be able to get these. And the one time that Alabama gets outbid or gets outclassed in recruiting, that is one time too many for Nick Saban. And that almost sound like a preacher in the middle of a revival with three offering plates saying, pass these around, dudes, and fill them up because this is not happening.
Ball game's changing, man.
Ball game's changing. You gotta keep up, and that's exactly the message that I think Nick Saban was trying to convey to all of those businessmen and women in Birmingham, Alabama, who may or may not support the Crimson Tide. We have a lot more thoughts on this, and we'll definitely be taking your thoughts as well. 615-737-1025. The convo continues. Campbell Knezovic, 1025, 1063, The Game, and The Game Nashville app. That's right. We just concluded halftime of Campbell and Knezovic. We're out of the locker room, back on the field, warming back up as I continue to slander Jimbo Fisher and Nick Saban and roast them for acting like children in front of a national audience. What better way to spend a Saturday here on these airwaves than to talk about those two dudes duking it out? And, man, it has been a lot of fun just breaking this down. And, Michelle, this also, like, this made me think of something else, too. Because Nick Saban did say the word, it's not sustainable for us. But you notice who, like, not else is talking about this being sustainable? Like, other schools outside of Alabama, you know? Like, Texas A&M obviously has done a damn good job of taking advantage of all the NIL and instant transfer rules and essentially the pay-for-play, even though it's not pay-for-play, but it kind of is pay-for-play. Era of college football. I mean, Jordan Addison, the best receiver in the sport, you could say, just left Pittsburgh to go to USC, and it wasn't because he just really likes the weather out there. It's there is an NIL deal attached, but it's changing the game.
Speaking of Pittsburgh, that's where I am right now.
Michelle, doing the show from Pittsburgh, and where Jordan Addison used to be, she pulled a reverse Jordan Addison. That's going to Pittsburgh and deciding to hang out in Pittsburgh instead of leaving Pittsburgh for more money and sunshine and sand. But
yeah, give me an NIL deal, Chase, if you're listening.
Michelle needs some name, image, and likeness money. But which is another thing too, not a lot of people have discussed, I guess, at least on this show, that's a big time move. Like college football and basketball too. It's it's free agency, and the landscape of this sport has completely changed to where it is now more like a professional sport than ever. And whether or not Nick Saban actually meant the complaining he was doing, or he was actually bellyaching because he's really that, you know, ticked off that Texas A&M got the number one recruiting class in the country, I don't know. However, like, I think he understands that this is changing and that this is, like, if you want to compete, you got to be able to fork up the money. Like, you look around, Texas A&M's recruiting class, Tennessee forking up essentially $8 million in their NIL collective for a high school quarterback who was a junior in high school whenever he's going to be the number one recruit or number one quarterback prospect in next year's class. $8 million is what that went for. Like, the game's changed to where you got to be able to fork it up if you want to be able to survive in college football.
Yeah, I mean, football and basketball too. I mean, we had on Robbie and Rex Road, Tom Izzo, Michigan State head basketball coach, a couple weeks ago around the tournament time. And essentially he said, you know, as a college coach right now, and this goes for basketball, this goes for football, And obviously those are the two main ones, but you have no off season because you take a look at, first off, the transfer portal has absolutely just blown up in the last like 2 years, and people will just go in the portal. Yep. I mean, there might not be, just test the waters, right? Can I go to another school? Can I profit off my name, image, and likeness, maybe in a different city? That's going to even play a role now, right? Mm-hmm. You think about even just a Nashville compared to, let's say, a Birmingham. The amount of businesses in a Nashville compared to there, it's night and day. But obviously, if you're on Alabama football, you're probably going to have no problem getting a local business, you know, to sponsor you, to help you out, and get an NIL deal there. But then maybe for some of the smaller sports, if you're in a city like Nashville, the business opportunities are endless. The market is so much bigger. So some of these maybe not high profile athletes and maybe just like a little bit lower on the totem pole, there's so many different factors in this. And you're right, it's changing the game. And right now we're in such a weird time because the NCAA, now they're trying to run it back and try to figure out a way to, I don't want to say like control this, but they're trying to figure out a way. I feel like they want to control it, but you can't now because, you know, you've already unleashed it. You can't run backwards. And I think, like, I personally think something that would be helpful is on these high profile teams, like, you don't want your student athletes getting taken advantage of.
Right.
And when it comes to businesses, you're still young, you're still a kid, and you're signing contracts, and some kids are signing agents, you know, those high profile athletes that are going to go to the professional level in 1 or 2 years, because you don't want them taken advantage of. And I think I am all for NIL and players being able to make money off. I mean, hey, everybody else makes money off them when they're playing for Alabama football. They should be able to make money. But it does open a lot of other doors and a lot of big question marks about how just college athletics as a whole is just changing so rapidly and so quickly. And now it's like, okay, how do they move forward? And what if, like, I always think too, what if, so say you're a Nike school, what if Adidas offers Oscar Tshiebwe a shoe contract, but
they wanted him to play for a school in which they're dressing out the team.
So, you know, you think about that, and that's obviously at the highest level, right? Mm-hmm. But you could even take it a couple levels lower. What if you have a Vanderbilt, like Marriott is the hotel of Vanderbilt or something like that. And say Hilton wants to sponsor Scottie Pippen Jr. So there's so many different layers to this. And when I was in college, I actually interviewed a professor at Syracuse who he specifically was in, you know, sports management, and his class was specific on NIL and playing players and all of that. And he just said, there are so many different layers to this. And he didn't even go into the fact of, you know, players just moving so rapidly and so quickly, but more of the business side of things. There's just so much to think about when it comes to this stuff. And you have no off season. Players are going all over the place. If they can make more money here, yep, I'm going to go there. Mm-hmm. And they're still young kids at the end of the day. So it's crazy. I feel like I went on a tangent, but there's just so many different, you know, branches and levels of all of this moving forward.
And it's a lot of it's because the NCAA never prepared for it. Like Mark Emmert was, I mean, I'm so glad that guy is no longer the head of the NCAA because he ruined the NCAA. No one intentionally ruined their own organization quite like him. Stubbornness and Mark Emmert ruined the NCAA. I don't say it's ruined because, like, there's ways for this to eventually settle back down. It's just so new right now that I think a lot of pundits are confusing new and different with bad. Like, just because this is all different, this is nothing we've never seen before, just because it's not the same model doesn't mean it's necessarily bad or it's going to ruin the game, because it's too early for that. You can hypothesize, but you don't know that for sure. But Mark Emmert and the NCAA, for a decade, when this all started rolling around and coming to be, never once thought of a model organized rules because they were so hell-bent on keeping mm-hmm. the amateurism model that they were going to have the NCAA as a whole go down with the ship and let everybody fend for themselves in their individual states because they were either too lazy, too stubborn, or just didn't care because they were raking in so much money from the college football playoff and college basketball men's and women's tournaments that they didn't give a you-know-what after that. And I think that's a large part of it. They have only themselves to blame because they never prepared for this. So to every coach and administrator.
They shot themselves in the foot.
Yeah. So to every coach and administrator, especially if you're an administrator in the NCAA, boo freaking who that this has gotten so hard because you could have prepared for this a long time ago and you refused to do it. But that, like, it does come back down to, at the end of the day, I think a lot of the reason these coaches are so against it is because they just don't have the control over a lot of these players that they used to, especially your Nick Sabans and Jimbo Fishers. But Jimbo has seemingly happily relinquished that control and relinquished that to be able to allow his friends and his connections to get him the best high school players in the country and essentially rebuild Texas A&M. Even though rebuilding, they've not really ever won a national championship, and rebuilding, build them into something maybe they have never been before. How about that?
Hey, don't disrespect the 12th man.
I will disrespect them all day. But and now that the Texas and Oklahoma are joining the joining the SEC too, it's going to get even crazier. But I actually do have a theory about all of this that it may seem crazy right now, because it is. It may seem like college football free agency, because it is. And it may seem like there is pay for play for high school players, because quite frankly, there is. But the numbers we see and the transfer portal numbers we see are definitely going to go down. I hypothesize in the next 3 or 4 years, and I will tell you why on the other side as Kamla Knezovic rolls right along right here on ESPN 102.5 The Game, 106.3 in The Game Nashville app. If it seems like college football's atmosphere is crazier than it's ever been, it's because it is. If it seems like high school players are getting paid to play for these college schools through third-party NIL collectives, it's because they are. And if it seems like paying $8 million for a junior high school quarterback to come play for your school whenever he graduates high school is a lot, it's because it bleeping is. But I think this will eventually settle down. I'm Elijah Campbell. She's Michelle Knezovic. Jared Cassidy behind the board bumping some Jeezy on this Saturday morning in ESPN 102.5 The Game, 106.3 in The Game Nashville app. And Michelle, it's a lot right now. But I think a lot of these kids like are going to learn lessons the hard way. And these businesses, these NIL collectives, are going to learn lessons the hard way. So here's my theory, and you tell me what you think. So $8 million for a high school quarterback. Say that kid goes, and Nico goes to Tennessee and stinks it up. It is Jonathan Crompton 2.0, where you have this highly touted quarterback for a school that is willing to cough up a lot of money for him, and they play poorly. That's a bad – you don't get any return on your investment. Say Jarrett Garantano, when he went to Tennessee, when coming out of high school, because he was the number one dual-threat quarterback in the country coming out of high school, he would have gotten $8 million in this market. So say he does what he does at Tennessee and becomes one of the more hated players in that amongst that fan base. Business isn't going to want to dole out $8 million to just anyone anymore. They're going to learn that lesson the hard way. All these kids are in the transfer portal. They think that they can, that the grass is greener on the other side. A lot of times it is, and they should have the freedom to do that. I'm not disputing that. But they go into the transfer portal, and no one wants them. They didn't get the attention they want, and then they're stuck, and they can't come back to school because then the school they left has already replenished their roster with recruits and transfers. These kids are going to learn some of those lessons the hard way because we saw that last year where a lot of players were stuck in the portal, and it's going to happen this year. We're going to have another record number of players that are stuck without a home to go to and still just holding on to college eligibility they may never use. So, Michelle, my theory is, all of this happens. Life will happen. Mistakes are going to be made that are going to cost businesses and players enough money to where it will naturally settle down to the point where you don't maybe see $8 million for a quarterback coming out of high school, but you might see one or two, or the NIL collective will think twice about poaching the best player from Sacred Heart University to come play at Kansas because it didn't work out very well once they got there, or whatever situation it may be. I do see a lot of regression in the landscape of college athletics just because that's the natural way of things.
No, Elijah, I agree with you. And I mean, right now, like we talked about, there's kind of just chaos going on throwing money, you know, at players. We want this recruit, we want that recruit. Like, we need Nico to come to Tennessee and things like that. And they don't really know. I feel like it's right now it's the highest bidder, right? They don't really know what their cap is, I guess you could say, right? Because if you think about it, they haven't even touched the field yet. And let's think about how many five-star recruits go to college in any sport and actually become what we think they could become, right? It's all about their potential. You're betting on them. This essentially could be, you're gambling, right? Okay, we're going to pay him $8 million. We need him to be the starting quarterback. He's the number one recruit. He's a five-star, all this stuff. Everybody wants him as QB. Okay, so now he gets to Tennessee, right? He's a freshman. Now it's Tennessee's job to develop him and help him with the transition from high school football to college football. But then what if they don't develop him well enough? And what if he's a flop? You think the collective's going to be happy about that?
Nope.
They start blaming Tennessee.
Yep.
They start blaming Tennessee. Well, why wasn't he prepared? Like, is this your fault? Could it flip around on the school? Hey, we just paid all this money. We're the car dealership or we're the Smith donors. Mm-hmm. What's happening? Why isn't he starting? Why isn't he Peyton Manning?
Yep, especially if they're not getting on the field, because you know how like parents are, like if their kids are on the field, they're going to talk to the coach that way, especially in high school. That's how these businesses are, because then these businesses invest lots of money. If your $8 million quarterback that you paid to get to the school isn't even sniffing the field because he's not that good, you are going to be so bleeping mad because you have wasted $8 million. I went back. Oh, continue, Michelle.
Really quick, one more point, Elijah. Well, they're running the show now, right? They can pull the, well, you didn't recruit him well enough.
Mm-hmm.
We got him here.
Yep. And then they're eventually going to hold a ton of power that they shouldn't hold, you know?
I bet college coaches just absolutely hate that NIL exists now.
Oh, they absolutely do, for multitude of reasons, because this is happening. And then they don't have control as much control over these players. These players have leverage power now. They've leverage for the first time in the history of the this equation here and in this NCAA college sports model. Players have a ton of power. Like, I went back to the 2012 top football recruits. The number one recruit in the country, according to 24/7, was Mario Edwards, a defensive tackle from Denton, Texas, who went on to play at Florida State. Would that have been an $8 million investment for Florida State? Would that have panned out? Dorial Green Beckham was number two, the best wide receiver in the country from Springfield, Missouri. He would end up going to Missouri. Say Missouri spent $5 million in an NIL collective to get him there. And it's great because he was really good. And I think he went to Oklahoma first. And then he got kicked off the team somewhere. He got kicked out of one school, I do remember. Before landing at Mizzou, because he actually played at Mizzou and was all right, but his draft stock fell because he got in trouble. But there's so many other players on here that never sniffed what they're supposed to be. DJ Humphreys, offensive tackle, number five recruit in the country. You think Washington would have paid, I think Florida would have paid a lot for that? Probably so. A lot. Like Kyle Murphy. Who's Kyle Murphy? Offensive tackle, Stanford. He could have gotten money somewhere if he was born 10 years later. But would that have been a great investment for Stanford? Probably not.
Well, when you think of $8 million, right? I mean, that's a lot of money. Like, that's an insane amount of money. And what player now in the NFL would be worth that? Well, now, but what, so you could say a Peyton Manning would have been worth that. A Tom Brady would have been worth that. Aaron Rodgers, right? All these players. Now, Tom Brady was average in college. He's not getting that.
He would not have sniffed that. Yeah.
Peyton Manning, obviously he was at Tennessee and was, I mean, he was Peyton Manning in college. Like what else can I say? But think about Archie Manning coming now and everybody's like, oh my gosh, he is going to be it. He is going to be the next Peyton Manning, right? Well, he could be Eli or he could be not close to either of them.
Yeah. So in this situation here, the number one pro style quarterback in high school football was Gunnar Kiel. He was the number 24 overall recruit in high school football. Notre Dame signed him. Say Notre Dame really wants this kid, and we're talking about the going rate for the number one quarterback recruit in the country. $8 million for Gunnar Kiel. You think there's South Bend businesses or NIL collectives that they would have had that would have been thrilled with Gunnar Kiel in hindsight? No. Like, I think we're gonna see so many instances in which these guys, which, as they should, make as much money in the window they can. You are worth as much as someone is willing to pay you in this type of environment.
Story quick.
Yes.
Gunnar Kiel lives in Nashville, and he is my best friend Sitzer's fiance, and I'm going to their wedding.
Ha! No way.
Yeah, but he was, like, listen. Like, highly he touted. Talked about it. He was a quarterback. You know, he was getting recruited by Bama. He was getting recruited by Notre Dame. Mm-hmm. And he was a kid who, out of high school, like you said, was a very coveted recruit. But his game didn't transfer well to college. And then he ended up transferring from Notre Dame because he didn't have the starting job to Cincinnati. And he had a kind of.
Hey, his 2014 season, he threw 31 touchdown passes. Had a really good season. But it wasn't worth it for Notre Dame because I don't think he ever took a snap for Notre Dame, you know?
And didn't get drafted. You know what I mean? Mm. So it's things you just don't know. It's just such a big gamble. And like I said, I think right now they're just highest dollar amount, right? Like how is this going to weigh out? Are they – I mean, I think right now, like you talked about, Elijah, it's going to tone back a lot.
Yeah.
But it is at the highest level right now because people just don't know how to navigate around it.
That's very true.
Navigate with it or ride the wave or figure it out or whatever you want to call it.
Yeah. The NCAA did such a poor job of preparing for this that it left it to handle itself naturally. Which,
and Mark Everett said, peace, I'm out of here.
He said, all right, I'm out. As he set fire to the building and walked away. In utter chaos, and it's like,
oh. Put a little oil on there as well.
Yeah, he said, not my pig, not my farm anymore. I'm out of here. And that dude split so fast, but it'll handle itself eventually, I believe. But a lot going on there. And Michelle, I don't know if you watched that Warriors Mavs game last night, but they're dangerous. The Boston Celtics defensively are very dangerous. Jared Cassie behind the glass is grinning ear to ear right now. He is eager to pump his chest at the Boston Celtics. They have a big game 3 tonight against the Miami Heat. We'll break down all the games going on, including some wild ones in the Stanley Cup playoffs, including a series which has already become, after 2 games, my favorite series in the postseason that I have ever seen so far. It's on pace to be. I'll tell you which one that is on the other side. It's Justin Campbell Knezovic here on ESPN 102.5 The Game, The Game Nashville app. NBA and Stanley Cup playoffs rolling right along. Had some great action last night. And I don't know if any of you guys watched that Flames-Oilers game. Absolutely bonkers. The first one might be the craziest hockey game I've ever seen in my life. 15 goals. The Flames won 9-6. The Oilers scored 6 goals in that game and never led at any point. That might be the first time I've ever seen that in my time watching hockey. And then, of course,
touchdowns out there.
It's cool. Touchdown, that the extra point. It still never led, Michelle. Never led in that game. And then last night, Mike Smith for the Oilers. Now, Mike Smith might be the funniest goalie in the history of the NHL because you have playoff Mike Smith, and then you have Mike Smith. And you had regular Mike Smith in the first period and a half last night where he gave up 3 goals on not a ton of shots and then stood on his head in the last 5 or 6 minutes of that game to give them that win.
Like, sorry, I accidentally, a video popped up on ESPN right there.
That's my big, I know it's not Friday at noon, so I can't put anybody on the list, but Michelle, I've eternally ESPN.com on the list because every box score you open has a video that pops up, whether it's an ad or a highlight that you did not want up there, it plays anyway. So I totally understand the pain there, but
send it to the moon.
send it to the moon. Send that feature to the moon because I don't want to watch a video unless I click on it. Okay. Like don't throw these videos in my face without my permission, but Michelle, I don't know if you've been keeping up with that series, but that might be one of the craziest, not just like hockey series or basketball series, even baseball, just in all sports. Like in 2 games, you have had some of the strangest outcomes that you could possibly get. I'm in love with it. I'm in sports crush mode right now over the Oilers and Flames series.
Well, and Elijah, I honestly wasn't that big of a hockey fan, you know, coming from New York, living in upstate New York. I'm not close to the Rangers or anything, and the Devils are in Jersey. And to be honest, the closest team to me is probably the Bruins, the easiest drive to Boston and stuff. And then moving to Nashville and just the ability to go to Predators games and this being tomorrow's my like official 1 year in Nashville.
Oh,
and
wow. Congratulations.
Congrats.
Thank you.
And one of us just, for a year.
Yeah, I know, right? Got the Tennessee driver's license. But just being like immersed in like hockey culture, I've never followed it as much as I have. One, because it's our job to follow the Predators. And
yes.
Two, but no, it is so enjoyable too. And, you know, people are listening and you aren't the biggest hockey fan. Like turn on these Stanley Cup playoffs right now, because like you said, that Flames game, absolutely incredible. The amount of just offensive manpower out there, and it's just so fun when you just see them like back and forth and just the amount of goals they're scoring. You don't see that very often in hockey, and to not only have that, and then to secondly, it be in a playoff situation. It's incredible, honestly. And I know that Predators fans are probably a little salty because they were hoping to get the Flames in the first round. Maybe the series could have probably turned out a different way, but man. I'm very excited to see this. I'm loving the Tampa Bay Lightning.
God, Oh, you're right, Michelle. Well, it was last week you said you thought the Lightning had honestly a really good chance to three-peat. Like three-peating in hockey is so damn hard. And I was this might be the year Toronto finally does it. And you called it Game 7. They went into Toronto and continued the misery of that city and their team. And then that first 2 games in Florida or in Sunrise, they steal on the road, including that goal with 4 seconds left from Ross Colton. Like, the Panthers are snake bitten, and the Lightning might just never lose a playoff game again. I'm convinced.
I mean, they're incredible. Between them and between the Bucks, is Tampa like the new New England, the new Boston?
I hate Tampa. So because random. So seemingly random.
Listen, I think Tom Brady just moves there and it just becomes a championship city.
He just like, he brings that aura with him.
He does. I mean, I don't even think we can dispute that. I mean, Pittsburgh for a while, they were like pretty solid, you know, city up here as far as championship wise.
You had the Penguins and Steelers stretch for a while because Steelers won that Super Bowl, I guess, from 2005 to 2017 when the Penguins won their last Stanley Cup. They won 2 Super Bowls and 3 Stanley Cups, I believe.
Five championship parades. Quick shout out to the best Pittsburgh people ever. My best friend's family, the Janoskos, who I'm sitting in her sister Brianne's bedroom right now doing the show. Caitlin Janosko, they're listening downstairs. So they are the biggest, you know, Penguins fan, Steelers fan. They go to some Pirates games. So,
well, I guess we'll forgive them for 2017 if they will allow you to conduct the show from their house. So thank you to them.
I guess we'll give them a little forgiveness.
Shout out Iron City.
Hey. There, yeah. We'll accept them. Yes. For one
just
show.
One. And then Predators, you can go back to, you know, being salty about about that game.
About 2017. We'll never forget. Honestly, in terms of like games that I have been so heartbroken about, game six of that final, that's up there for me. That one, that was a killer. Because that was a really good game. And then one goal off of Pecorine's back, scored by a former Predator. That one hurts a little bit in hindsight.
So that was 2017. The first time I went to a Predators game was in 2018. Kara Hammer.
Kara,
let me shadow her. So I was a senior, I think, in college, or junior in college, senior in college. Drove down from Lexington. Kara Hammer let me shadow her for a game. They were playing the Penguins in Bridgestone. Like, I think it was the first time they played them, you know, after that series. Kara lets me shadow her for the game. And of course, the environment is just absolutely insane.
Bonkers.
And that was
the
first Preds game I'd ever gone to. And I was like, oh, this is insane, you know, coming off obviously that big run and then having the Penguins in Bridgestone. And they ended up losing in a shootout that night. And I was like driving back from Lexington, like, oh my gosh, that was incredible. Mm-hmm. And also shout out Kara Hammer, because she's the one who got me in touch with Ryan Porth, and that's how I am here. So.
If it wasn't for that, then we don't have this show right now. So
yeah,
it's funny how the first domino falls.
Story,
and now here we are.
Story time moment.
Yeah. A story of fate. But speaking of, like, fate, funny word, teams of fate. It kind of feels like too, that the Celtics might be a team of destiny too, because I don't know how. Like, Michelle, tell me if you saw this coming. I figured the Celtics would win game two just because they're so good on the road, right? Mm-hmm. They won that game six on the road in Milwaukee. Mm-hmm. They won both games on the road against Brooklyn. And they beat Miami. They were up at one point by 30-plus points against Miami. Not many teams go into another team's home arena and shoot 50% from three, but the Boston Celtics did. And then throw into the mixture that they have one of the best defenses in the NBA. I think them and Golden State have the two best, but Boston has here's my theory, is that Golden State's a better team defense. Boston is a better group of defenders, if that makes sense. But to me, it almost kind of feels like the Celtics team has everything that they need to win. And if you're making me put money down on any of these teams left, I think I'm putting it on Boston.
Elijah, I agree. I think that they have, I mean, it's not like March Madness where you have that fairy tale team, but nobody really talked about the Celtics this year. I mean, they were kind of just there, and they cruised through, they had a good record. I think they played three games against Miami. I think Miami only won one of them in the regular season, but it was the most recent one, you know, coming off it. We see them sweep the Nets. Like, who would have thought that would have happened?
Yeah. You know, it's crazy too. Like, if they don't have that awesome last play of the game in game one, where they inbound the ball, they have like 4 seconds left. They go coast to coast, make like three passes in 4 seconds, including the one to Jason Tatum, where he still has the composure to catch, spin, shoot the layup as the buzzer goes off to win that game. If that doesn't happen, they go down 0-1. And who knows how that series goes after that.
I think, like, I will stand here and say that was probably one of the most incredible basketball moments I've ever seen. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's better than any three-point buzzer beater. I mean, obviously, if there was more on the line, right? If this was a NBA Finals Game 7, right? But, I mean, the composure, and, like, that was the first, you know, everybody had their eyes on Jason Tatum after that play against the Nets. Nobody thought that the Celtics were going to beat the Nets in this series. They had Kyrie and KD on the other side.
And Kyrie went bonkers in Game 1. Almost a historic Game 1.
Yeah. It's not like they even had bad games. And for Jason Tatum to hit that, I remember like thinking, oh, wow. And we have watched Jason Tatum emerge. I've said this a lot on the show, emerge in front of our eyes as a superstar throughout this series, consistently with poise, doesn't get nervous. Well, I mean, he probably gets nervous, but doesn't show that he's nervous or tense or anything, and has been putting this team on his back. I mean, and just like Boston just looks like the most cohesive team, I think. I mean, you have all these role players stepping up. You have Grant Williams, who hit 7 threes in the TD Garden, you know, against the Bucks in game 7. You just beat the defending champions. Like,
I thought, which was the biggest hurdle. I mean, like, that might have been, like, Miami's good, and I really like this Miami team. I love the quote-unquote heat culture. I think Spoelstra is one of the better coaches of our generation.
1,000%.
And that team, speaking of role player, I think outside of the Bucks and the Celtics, I think they had the second-best batch of role players still remaining in the NBA. Like, that was – like, the Heat have – they still have a lot of things that make the Bucks good, right? But I just like the way Giannis played in this playoff stretch. It was his crown until someone took it, you know. Mm-hmm. And the fact that Boston took it, I think, was a bigger hurdle than they're facing with Miami, because I think when Miami doesn't have Jimmy Butler going, and if Kyle Lowry's not there to facilitate the offense, it can get a little stale for them offensively. And I know they're great defensively. They can switch 1 through 5, and Bam Adebayo might be one of the top 3 best defensive big men in the sport. Yep. And a top 5 or 6 best defensive player in the sport. He goes quiet on the offensive end. And if the Celtics are just making even a fraction of the shots they were hitting in game 2, they can win this thing in 6. So that series is still going to be interesting. Tonight's a big game, too, and a surprising spread on this. It's a 6.5-point game. And before we get our picks on the other side, I'll leave you with this stat to think about. There have been, in the last 30 NBA playoff games this season, 20 of them have been decided by 10 or more points, including the Warriors' win over the Mavericks last night. So, if you like the Celtics to win, do you take those 6.5 points, or you give away those 6.5 points? It's a tough question. We'll get into it on the other side as you're listening to Campbell Knezovic right here on ESPN 102.5, 106.3 The Game, and The Game Nashville app. It's the best segment of the show. It's time for us to make some gambling picks here on Campbell and Knezovic, as we always save for the last segment of the show. And I teased before the break, the line, at least on my favorite sportsbook app, which I will not name unless I'm paid to do so, is Celtics -6.5. Now, it sounds like a lot of points. And in a lot of circumstances, I think these two teams are actually really close. But there's a weird trend, Michelle, where out of the last 30 games in these NBA playoffs, 20 of them have been decided by double digits. So that makes me kind of lean Celtics -6.5. So in honor of the former give and go segment, are you giving or going with Celtics -6.5 tonight?
No way.
No way. Jimmy okay.
Butler, Jimmy Butler, I think his words were, that was embarrassing after
it was.
The game the other day. And if you watch Jimmy Butler as a player, you know that guy, when he says something like that, he is about to come back and absolutely go off in this next game. I actually think that the Heat win this one.
Oh, wow. Okay. Going with the Heat. So you're expecting a Jimmy Butler bounce back here.
Oh, 100%. I mean, after that loss, I think if the Celtics win this one by more than 7 points, then the Heat are in a little bit of trouble for this series.
And yeah, I mean, I think the Heat are in trouble in general if Kyle Lowry doesn't come back. Like, I know Kyle Lowry isn't going to be a difference maker and make up 25 points, but like, he gives you another option to run the show. Like, I think the biggest problem with the Heat right now is offensively, they can get stale if Jimmy Butler's not scoring 40 points. Like, he had 40 points in the game 1 win. Against the Celtics, 41 to be exact, in the game 1 win against the Celtics. In the closeout game against the Sixers, he had 32 but took 29 shots. And then the game against the Sixers where they went up 3-2, so game 5, Jimmy Butler went, well, he only scored 23 in that one, but they didn't have to score much because they held the Sixers to 85. Jimmy Butler's stat line is going to be the most important thing here. Like, they rely on him to be the leading scorer a lot, and the role players usually step in. I don't think the Heat win unless you get at least 15 from Tyler Hero. Bam yes. Adebayo has to be aggressive offensively because Jimmy Butler is going to need help on that side of the ball. All of those guys are fantastic defenders. Max Strus has turned out to be a really good defensive player. Caleb Martin probably should get more minutes, turned out to be a really good defensive player. Gabe Vincent really solid defensive player, but shouldn't be relied upon to be the number two scorer. And that's what happened in game one, or game two, was they relied a little too much on Jimmy Butler, and those guys couldn't come back and kind of give him some help. So I think if the Heat are going to win tonight, which wouldn't be surprised because it's not like the Celtics have been lights out on their home court,
They're
going to need those guys to be able to step up and help Jimmy because he's going to require a lot of defensive attention. The Celtics have thrown so many bodies at him. And they switch everything, and it's not like Jimmy Butler's seen one primary defender all game. I know Marcus Smart was the defensive player of the year, but it's Marcus Smart, it's Jason Tatum, it's Jaylen Brown, who I think is actually the best defender on that team, and then it's Time Lord Robert Williams meeting him at the rim or in the paint. The Celtics defense has been awesome to watch. Jared, our resident Celtics fan, Celtics minus 6.5. Are you giving or going?
Man, the spread is kind of scary because this is the early rubber match, right? You know, the three games in, we'll figure it out. I do think the Celtics will pull this one. I do think that the home crowd will get it. But I would honestly take the Heat with the points.
Okay, taking the Heat with the points. And I kind of hope it is within six points. Like the trend in basketball right now with all these blowouts does kind of hurt the product just a wee bit. But I would like to see some good games here. And I think that's really possible. And if we're going to get them, I think it's going to happen in this series more so than the Warriors and Mavs series. I just think the Warriors are a much better team than the Mavericks. The Mavericks might have the best player available in these playoffs right now, but they might have the lesser team top to bottom.
And but they also need, if they want to be in the game, they need Luka to be having more than 40 points a game. I mean, he had 42 last night. That's what he has to have consistently.
Had 42 last night, and they still blew a 14-point halftime lead and still lost by double digits.
At some points, he just looks like he's like the only one out there playing sometimes.
Mm-hmm.
And you just that's going to be hard to win against a team like the Warriors. If it was a lesser opponent, I would say that they have more of a chance. But just Warriors coming at them.
Playing Steph, it's kind of hard.
It's gonna be an uphill battle for those dudes. But like, I think they'll steal a couple games. Like the game tomorrow, the Mavericks are favored by 2.5. I think I'll take them -2.5. I think they'll get one game in where Doncic goes crazy, Jalen Brunson gives you 25, Dorian Finney-Smith hits about 3 or 4 threes.
And the Warriors shoot themselves in the foot and probably have like 15, 20 turnovers.
Exactly. Because like my problem with the Warriors isn't exactly that like they were average offensively this year. They were just elite defensively. Right. But they can get so careless with the ball sometimes and it bites them in the rear. And I think game three is when that will happen. So I'm kind of feeling Mavericks 2.5. Michelle?
Yeah. Give me the Mavs. I think I picked the Mavs yesterday for I think the Warriors were favored by 6 or 8. I forget what the spread
6.5 yesterday I think is what it closed at. That's where I got it at.
So then the Warriors ended up covering that last night, which for a while I thought it was pretty promising for the Mavs. I really wish they kind of would have sealed the deal on that one, but give me the Mavs for this one. I think, you know, once you get into game three, like you don't want to go down 3-0. So right now it's like the Warriors are feeling comfortable. Okay, we're up 2-0, feeling good. But then on the flip side, the Mavs and Luka, they know that they cannot go down 3-0 because then you're going to have to win 4 games in a row if you want to try to close out this series. Mm-hmm. And I think we could see a Warriors sweep. Like that very well could happen, but I don't think it will, just based off Luka. And I know it might feel like Jared said, Luka versus Steph, KD, KD's not on the Warriors
anymore.
Clay and Draymond, but I think the Mavs cover that 2.5 in this next game as well.
Jared?
Yeah, I'll take the Fighting Mark Cubans.
The Fighting Mark Cubans. I feel like you're going to get their best shot. If any game in the series in which you're getting the Mavericks' best shot, I feel like it's got to be game three.
For sure. Their backs are against the wall right now. Like, it's go or go home. So, you know.
And I think you'll get a big game from the Latvian Laser.
Yeah.
Davis Bertāns.
Oh, I was like, what?
Latvian Laser. One of the best nicknames in basketball. We're all in agreement. It's the Mavericks -2.5, which means the Warriors will probably win.
I think really quick, too, we should make our our picks on who we think will be in that final series.
Ooh, that's good. Okay. Oh, that's good. Okay. So I still like the Celtics to beat the Heat, right? I think the Celtics win this in six. I think the Heat steal game four on the road. Celtics take the last two. And I think we have a Boston Golden State. Golden State wins in five against Dallas. And I have the Celtics over the Warriors in seven in the NBA Finals.
Michelle? So I think that the Warriors win in six. I think the Mavs take a little bit longer. So I think definitely the Warriors coming out of the West, which not really surprised on that one.
Mm-mm. Given their track record.
And I think this is like one of the Warriors' last shots at a championship.
Oh, yeah. I think so, too.
You know, it's kind of like this is like their last hurrah, like their one last dance of these guys all together and everything like that. So the Warriors out of the West, and then this Boston Heat series is just really, really tough for me. I think 1,000% it goes to seven games. Like I'm very confident in that it'll go to seven games. And for pretty much all of the regular season, I had the Heat. But like I said, the Celtics' momentum in this postseason playoff push.
That defense.
Which hurts me to say it because I love the Heat. I love D-Wade and Jimmy Butler. And they got a couple Kentucky guys, Tyler Hero and Bam. But I think it's the Celtics. And then I think the Celtics beat the Warriors in seven.
Okay. Celtics and Warriors in seven. Jared.
Well, I got to piggyback off of Michelle because I was going to say Celtics, Warriors in seven. I just think Celtics are tough, man. They have been playing They have been playing some great ball the last couple months. I texted Elijah and said this week and said Celtics in six against the Heat. I will take the Celtics and the Warriors in the finals in seven.
All right. So it looks like we're all in agreement. This Boston team,
did we just
team,
all pick the Celtics to win it in seven?
I think we just cursed them. I think we just doomed Boston in the worst way possible. But we'll see how it goes. That game is going to be tonight, game three between Boston and Miami. Game three for Dallas and Golden State will be tomorrow night. But coming up next here on ESPN 102.5, 106.3, the game Nashville app, White Sox at Yankees, a little Saturday matinee baseball. What can beat that? Crack open a cold one, listen to some baseball on the radio. White Sox, Yankees, coming up next.
Sliced bread.